Hello, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and by my side, as always, is Steve.
Not quite by your side. By your side via Zoom. How's that?
In spirit,
In
yep.
spirit. There we go.
And a lot of changes have happened during this whole pandemic and shutdowns, and along with FinTech too, we lost a business model, maybe.
We did, yeah. It just came out this week that LendingClub, which is really at the forefront of the peer-to-peer lending space, has sort of changed their model. So if you remember from maybe 8 years ago or so, their model was that they would enable peer-to-peer lending by having borrowers and also lenders, so that you, John, could be a lender. But they announced that at the end of this year, they're going to end what they call their notes program, which means that you can no longer invest in other people through the LendingClub platform.
Do you know if that's just the consumer side, or are they still going out like wholesale investors, like institutions?
I think that they're basically they're getting money from the institutional side, and now they actually acquired a bank as well. Maybe a month or two ago, they sort of changed their model, but it sort of signals really the end of this kind of notion of the peer-to-peer lending space, which is so popular, it seems like 5 years ago or so, right? It seemed like it was so huge. But interesting to note here is that when LendingClub went public back in 2014, it was valued at $9 billion.
It was a
Now
hot new thing.
it was a hot new thing, yeah. Now their market cap, because it went public, of course, is $380 million. So a 96% decrease in value.
Just a bit outside. And you mentioned, remember 8 years ago for our Gen Z listeners, that was when you were in middle school. That's a little while ago that they've been around. But yeah, it looks like a peer-to-peer is kind of faded away. I haven't really noticed that. I haven't heard that before, but it seemed like it would be like a new way of getting money out to people who needed it. But other people have filled in that gap without the peer-to-peer model, right?
They have, yeah. It's one of those terms that also sort of like the sharing economy that no one uses anymore, that sort of signals a signal or a shift rather in the way in which we view these platforms. So,
They
yeah.
all become let's make money economies instead.
As they should.
All right, yeah, the constantly shifting world and very complicated. And luckily, we have someone that can help us parse through some of that fintech world. We have Nick Frederick, President of Rebar Technology Solutions. How are you doing? Welcome to the podcast.
I'm doing well, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're in a very interesting part of the fintech world.
Yes.
Tell us, what is the focus of Rebar Technology Solutions?
Yeah, Rebar Technology. So our name is a little bit of an acronym, a loose acronym standing for Recurring Billing and Revenue Solutions. So as it
Ah,
sounds,
cool.
we target the subscription space, focusing on, back-end technology solutions that support merchants who operate in that space.
Oh, so what is the pain point that you see the most that you're like, oh, this is I'm so glad I'm in this space to get rid of this problem that people are having.
Yeah, well, so Rebar Technology, we're a sister company to a consulting company called W Capra, based out of Chicago, that's been around for about 20 years. Rebar is really only a couple years old, but when we were doing consulting engagements, we worked with merchants of all types, retail to e-com to subscription. And we got to see it from a lot of different angles through those processes. And one thing that really stood out to us, and it's really no surprise given the size of the merchant profile that we deal with, which is typically, Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 size organization, is that they're all different. Right. There's no two that are exactly alike, even if they operate in the same space. And so through those consulting engagements, we work with them from, strategy to supplier selection and technology roadmaps, things of that sort. And through those processes, we would document business requirements. And what we saw when we went out to RFPs in a lot of cases were you'd get a lot of suppliers that would say, yes, we can do this, we can do that. As happens, and then you get into the implementation phase, which we would still be involved in program management, project management, and things like that. And we would see that, oh, well, you said it would do this, but that wasn't exactly true, was it? It works like that. And in the proliferation of SaaS solution providers that are out there in the market right now, a lot of those are one size fits all approach. So for Rebar, we took a, we kind of twisted that a little bit and said, okay, we're not just going to go build another mousetrap here. We want to take a different approach to this. So we've really built our platform to be modular, in such a way that we can take all of the different components that you need in the subscription lifecycle, from identity management, billing, revenue recognition, tax, all of those different things that you have to solve for, and built our platform in a way that you can use this component or that component, or plug in a third party component if you've got a provider that you already work with that you really like, and put those things out in a solution or in a customized configured platform that operates just for that client. So rather than, you know, the typical multi-tenant SaaS approach, we take a more of a customized configuration type approach that gives us the benefits or the speed to market that comes from SaaS, but leverages the, you know, the customization that you can get from, you know, pure custom development without the hefty price tag that goes along with it.
Oh, so you provide the base and you make it easy for them to make those connections so that they don't have to do all the manual or heavy lifting on all the translation kind of stuff with all the different services they might
exactly want. I like that word translation there. That's a good one. Everybody, you know, we've all got APIs today, but they all work differently, right? And some are SOAP, some are REST, some are Graph. There's a lot of different communication protocols out there, but even within one of those, you know, they're all different. And we found through our consulting engagements, in a lot of cases, a merchant would say, oh, I want vendor A and vendor B, and I want vendor A to, you know, process transactions through vendor B. And those two vendors would look at each other and go, oh, I don't talk to you. So how are we going to work together here? And so, you know, we would work through kind of hefty, meaty projects to make those two platforms talk to each other. And, you know, a lot of times there were business rules that were, you know, inserted along the way. And so we build in functionality for that. But yeah, to your point, we translate from A to B is really, I think, what our strength is.
Oh, so you were really right there seeing the pain point up front. This wasn't like a theoretical kind of problem. Yeah. You were like, oh, this guy is actually, you know, needs this. Were you able to get up and running very quickly with deployments?
We did. And that is quite honestly, thanks to just advances in technology. So we operate everything in the cloud. You know, we operate just like a lot of people on AWS and Azure for a lot of our services, primarily mm-hmm. AWS, but we've embraced serverless technology. So Lambdas and things like that, which allow us to really scale our platforms and develop them, quite frankly, very quickly. We don't operate a data center. We keep everything in the cloud, so we didn't have to go through all of that pain, nor do we need to keep up with it from an infrastructure perspective. We really allow AWS, you know, through these serverless applications to do that for us. So it allowed us to scale very quickly and efficiently than if we had even done this 5 years ago. It's pretty amazing.
It seems like so much of the e-commerce and payments, like your kind of services, are doing well during the pandemic. I assume that's true for you guys as well. But do you wish you had started like 6 months or a year earlier, so you would have been even more prepared?
Oh, of course. I mean, that's always going to be the case. You know, me running this business unit always wishes we were further down the path than we are. But, you know, to think about where we've come in just 2 years, it's pretty amazing. And like I said, it's no doubt in part to that, the advances in technology and us to really focus our developers' time on things that really drive value to our clients rather than, you know, worrying about patching servers.
So why split off this company from the main consulting or professional services company, and why now?
Yeah, good question. Really the primary reason is our consulting business really tries to take an agnostic approach to suppliers, right? So we would come in, work really alongside and be an advocate for that merchant. And we wouldn't get into the technology development or solution space. We would just help find the right set of suppliers and then manage through those projects. So like I said, just tried to take that agnostic approach in all cases. Rebar, while we're agnostic to all kinds of different great suppliers that are out there in the marketplace for the subscription ecosystem, we are providing a specific product here. I mean, we refer to it as SBS, the subscription billing service, but that's a conglomeration, like I've said, of a lot of different modules that we put together. And so, you know, that's just our our way of separating out something that is providing a distinct product versus something that is a more of a service in our consulting side.
Do you focus on any specific industry or sub-industry, or just if this is a pretty industry agnostic solution?
It's definitely subscription. So within that domain, you know, there's different verticals, whether it's insurance, OTT streaming, box of the month clubs, you know, all of those different types of groups. And we can support any one of those. Although it's definitely worth noting that, you know, the mechanics of that and some of the specific needs and requirements of a vertical are different. You know, certainly insurance has different ones compared to, you know, your Netflixes of the world versus Amazon versus, you know, any box of the month club or that's out there. There's certainly different needs when you're talking about physical versus digital goods and things like that.
I've used a service called Trim, which basically I give it access to all my financials and it tells me where my money goes, right? I pay for Netflix, Spotify, Disney Plus, sure, whatever. And then it tells me essentially, you know, you've used as you have, and I can also cancel it from the app. This sounds like taking that same model, but for an enterprise, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. It's interesting. Services like that have popped up are because this subscription industry has grown so much. And it became hard for consumers to keep up with all of the different places that they were being charged, all of the different, you know, debit and credit cards and all of these different places. But yeah, that one there is a good example of, you know, what has come up as the industry has grown.
We mentioned, I think before we started recording here that you might have seen some interesting data points in terms of how COVID has affected your business and how it has grown. Can you walk us through some of the insights that you've gleaned from the past, you know, 6 or 7 months or so, or however long this pandemic has been going on?
However long it's been going on, right?
Yeah, it feels like 4 years, but yeah.
Easily. As this is probably comes as no surprise, but as consumers have spent more time at home, a lot of the services for the types of organizations that we support have grown. And so OTT streaming or over-the-top streaming is a great example of that, right? We've seen HBO Max, Peacock, you know, a lot of these services pop Quibi. Up over the past couple of years. And those that are established have just seen exponential growth in terms of subscriber base over this time. And, you know, that's just, of course, as a result of consumers just being home more. And I would say even, you know, physical goods as well. So Amazon obviously has grown tremendously throughout the pandemic. It's almost shocking the rate that they've grown. But, yeah. You know, consumers a lot of us are just concerned about going to the store. So if we avoid it, if we can. So, you know, the home meal kit delivery services, what had an explosion there a few years ago, and then really took a dip from there as, you know, consumers just got saturated with it. So many popped up and they tried so many, some had good experiences, some had bad experiences, but then COVID happened and, you know, didn't want to go to the grocery store if they didn't have to. So, you know, they saw big growth as well. Now it'll be interesting to see what happens if we're able to get through this or when we get through it, kind of what those sort of services look like on the other side. But it's been tremendous growth. I saw an article on payments.com the other day that said throughout the pandemic in the US, 96 million new subscriptions were created.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Huh. So what is some advice you have for somebody just starting out? It looks like you guys had a running start, but you did just start last year, which is, you know, pretty,
yeah,
used to a young fintech. Do you already have some things you wish you'd done different or
oh, absolutely.
Avoided absolutely. Already? Yeah, everybody does, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, what advice would you have?
Well, you know, I'm not the first to say this, but don't be afraid to fail. We tried a lot of different things mostly in terms of technology as we were getting going. And, you know, we chose to use some more, I don't want to call them bleeding edge, but certainly cutting edge technologies, the serverless that I was talking about before, which are just a little bit less established compared to some of the other ones. And there was a lot of learning to be done through that time. And, you know, we've developed a lot of different, we've adjusted our processes over time. So we've tried to be as agile as we can, you know, as agile of a shop, just in terms of our processes, the technologies that we use, how we bring resources on board, you know, to grow our business, just trying to continuously evolve and learn. We have weekly meetings with the team where we get back together and, kind of look at the past sprint. We're doing 1 week sprints right now in terms of development. That's pretty short in today's terms, but we just find that it's just a good place to check in with everybody, see how our projects are going, kind of what we're achieving. And like I said, just kind of learn as we go. And we've learned some painful lessons along the way. You know, when we're growing as quickly as we are and bringing on new resources, you know, you go through the interview process and you think you do a good job and you make a great connection with somebody and you bring them on board and you think they're going to, you know, own the world, and they get going for a while. And you find out later that, wow, that they kind of didn't know as much as they said they did and probably didn't reach out for help as soon as they should have. But, you know, also shame on us for probably not checking in as quickly as we should have. So, you know, those are lessons that we had to learn along the way. And we pigeonholed ourselves a couple times in terms of just the technology choices that we made. But like I said, doing those continuous check-ins to get feedback from everybody kept us from going too far down these holes and not being able to back out of them, or at least not being too expensive to back out of them. So, you know, especially in our early going here, communication among the team is just, it's just so critical, you know, to just continue learning, continue evolving. And it helps with us feeling like a team, you know, because this isn't, this isn't just, you know, my vision or one or two people's vision for a company. It's all of us. And it's fun to collaborate.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So John is in San Francisco. I'm in the East Bay. And we always hear about the exodus of talent from the area, sort of escaping the housing costs and the homelessness. Yeah. Are you seeing that influx of talent into Nashville now?
We are, in fact. Developers are hard to come by in this town, especially good ones. So it's we're trying to stay plugged into the community here, you know, all of the different groups that get together. In areas that are relevant to us. Nashville's got a great software school that's cranking out new candidates. But, you know, we're, of course, now living in this virtual world, and it's more prevalent than ever to work remotely. And, you know, in certain cases, we're able to pick up resources outside of our area. We really try to focus on the Nashville market just because we found that, you know, and again, this is a little bit pre-COVID, even if we weren't all in the office every day, we would try to get together on a recurring basis and just be there to just, you know, be face to face. And there's just certain conversations that happen, you know, when you're physically in the same area as somebody than happens over Slack or Teams or, you know, whatever your communication method is of choice. So it's a different way of working together for sure.
I also know Nashville sort of being a center for health tech, right? It seems like there's a lot of health tech stuff in Nashville. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We've it's funny, most resources that go into that space or start in that space don't tend to leave it. There's of course a lot of there's a lot of knowledge and terminology that you pick up along the way there, and so it tends to be a career if you get into healthcare, but there's certainly been others who have come in and out of it. But it's huge here. You know, we've got HCA, the largest operator of hospital beds in the country. Wow. That's headquartered here, and a number of other businesses that work in insurance and, you know, hospital management and things like that. But yeah, it's a pretty massive industry here.
So billing and payment infrastructure valuations have really taken off. Stripe has done very well.
Yes.
You work with those directly as part of your integrations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we're not a merchant acquirer. We don't, you know, present transactions on their behalf, but we do integrate with them. So, you know, all of the popular ones that are out there, certainly they're Stripe, but larger merchants tend to work with some different platform providers. You know, the First Data, Worldpay, Adyen, Chase Payment Techs of the world we're integrated with. So yeah, it's a big industry, and you're right. Valuations are kind of skyrocketing right now. Even amongst some that I would maybe put in a competitor category are getting huge investments right now as well. So they're certainly seeing opportunity for growth.
Oh, so what's the big next step for you guys? What would you like to see happen in the next 6 months to a year or so?
Yeah, good question. We want to, we're still relatively new. We've got our first few merchants that are up and getting live on the platform right now. And we're really focused on just flawless execution right now, quite frankly, making sure that we live up to our commitments, you know, because reputation absolutely matters here. The good and the bad of the subscription space is that our clients are They're hard to get, and the sales cycle is very, very long, but the relationships are tend to be long as well. And, you know, we want to have a satisfied base of clients that grow with us, or we grow with them, and then, you know, are great referrals for us as we continue to get out there. Unfortunately, been a part of way too many situations in my career, both as a consultant and being on the other side of the fence before I did this, where, you know, there's just promises made that aren't lived up to, and you know, certain vendors just aren't the right fit for certain merchants, and we want to make sure that we live up to the commitments, that we provide, you know, the highest level of service that we can. And you know, I think one of our advantages of being a part of W Capra is just the consultative approach that we take. You know, we really want to understand our clients' business, what they do, how they do that, what differentiates them, and then make sure that what we're providing from a service perspective, even if that's, you know, our technology platform, but, you know, the advice that we give them, you know, trying to stay in front of rules and regulations that are impacting them out there in the industry, which are just constantly evolving, staying on top of those and educating them and being their advocate along the way.
Yeah, I'm sure compliance is a challenge. I'm always paranoid about that. I'm always asking about that. But actually, I was curious about security. First of all, people are going to have a lot of questions for you about what you can provide for that. Yeah. They don't want to be on the front page of some newspaper someday. And then what can you do to provide that security, to provide that reassurance?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, first and foremost, we are PCI level one service provider compliant. So we had to go through that audit, and which, you know, is a lengthy, very, you know, in-depth process to make sure that all of the systems, the people, all of the controls that you have in place around storing sensitive data are there and that they're being followed. And you know, it even goes as far as education within the organization, making sure that everybody understands what PCI compliance is and how to make sure that, you know, you're following it, staying educated and things like that. So, you know, that's the big one. PCI is certainly the big one. That's, you know, directly for credit card processing, although the same applies whether you're handling, you know, DDA accounts for ACH or other payment instruments. But, you know, it's not lost on us that we are handling some of an organization's most sensitive data. And so making sure that we earn that trust by walking them through what we do, how we hold it, how we handle their data. One of the differentiators that I was talking about before is that each of our merchants' applications, once we plug everything together for them, runs in a dedicated environment. So none of a merchant's data is co-tenant sitting alongside anyone else's. It's in its own environment. They have access to it if they want direct access to it. But we just try to treat each individual merchant client differently and treat their data with the highest level of sensitivity that that we can.
Yeah, sure. That's still like the base level requirement these days. And then still really things is. Still happen. When you see that kind of thing, Capital One or something like that, what's the thought that's going through your head, like as to what must have happened?
Oh, it's the chaos that's happening within that organization.
Really?
Yeah.
At that time, but I mean, to allow that to happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think one thing, and so before I did consulting and started Rebar here, I worked at a merchant for 11 years, and it was a pretty sizable merchant that was called Affinion Group, but we processed over 1 billion payment transactions a year. So very high volume environment and a lot of complex systems and products, and we really service financial institutions. So, you know, Capital One, you know, when that happened was right at the forefront, but, you know, I think for at that time when I was with that very large organization, the key to success there, I think, is making security not just one person's job. It's easy to say it's the CISO's job, right? And it is. Don't get me wrong, but
it's making all sure of our jobs.
Exactly right. It's everyone's job, and they as much their job is to educate the rest of the organization, to make them all feel like we're all responsible for this. It's not just one department of five people sitting over here that's responsible for data security. It's everybody. And so, you know, their job is as much educating on, you know, how to identify problems and also incidents will happen, right? How do we react to them? How do we notify our clients? How do we How do we communicate internally when these things happen? How do we triage it? You know, how do we identify root cause and communicate from there? But, you know, it's definitely about making it an organization-wide program and not just one person's job.
Stop clicking on those links, Steve, please.
I can't help myself. It's free stuff.
You got this USB stick outside? What the hell is going on here? So what do you see right now? You guys look at a lot of different companies, and you're working a lot of touching on a lot of areas. What do you see in fintech that's interesting or exciting to you these days?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, AI and kind of what that brings to the table. As it relates to the payment space, where we see this being applied the most is fraud screening. There are certainly some service providers out there who focus on that exclusively. Others have purchased it as more of a white label solution. But what, you know, these fraud screening systems are really looking for patterns of fraudulent activity, you know, high risk activity. And I think that presents a lot of opportunity for our industry because the US has the highest rate of interchange. So the discount rate on a payment transaction versus anywhere else in the world, we have the highest. And a big part of that is you're almost buying insurance with every transaction in case a merchant, you know, doesn't do what they say they're going to do, doesn't provide the goods or services, or goes belly up and doesn't do it. And someone's liable for those transactions, right? So there's a little piece of insurance that goes into all of those transactions. If we find a way to make transactions more reliable and more secure, then the cost of them as a whole will theoretically go down. Now, whether that gets passed down to, you know, merchants and ultimately consumers remains to be seen. And there's certainly lawsuits out there that might indicate that doesn't always happen. But I think that's a real opportunity for our industry is to try to all work together to make these transactions, you know, just operate as smoothly and securely as we can. And I think AI is a big way to make that happen.
So a smarter AI to detect these kind of fraudulent transactions. So is the U.S. targeted more, or it just generally has more losses?
I wouldn't say necessarily targeted more recently. I think it had to do with the fact that really credit cards were born here in the U.S., proliferated here in the U.S. first before, you know, spreading throughout the world. And so we have the most complicated payment system in the world, the most number of issuers, the most number of financial institutions. And, you know, sometimes that can cause chaos and whatnot. But I think as, you know, payments have grown and gone global, and we've had all of these advances in technology, the game is really changing here. And I think there's opportunities there now to improve it that just weren't there before.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. It's just a complex world and a complex market.
It is. It's a very complex market. Yeah.
What do you think? You know, we mentioned central bank digital currencies recently. Mm-hmm. What do you think of those developments in whether it's a central bank or Bitcoin or other types of crypto or digital currencies?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't by any means call myself an expert in any of them, but I think the key piece that's going to be required for them to get any traction is consumer acceptance. And I think acceptance is only going to start with education. Because I think if you talk cryptocurrency to the average consumer, they just know it as a word. Like, they don't understand what it is. They don't understand how it works. They don't understand how to utilize it. They just know that they have an uncle who trades it somewhere and either made a lot of money or lost a lot of money on it. But, you know, if it's going to succeed, it needs to have a cleaner way to inform consumers of the value proposition that it brings. Otherwise, we're just going to keep talking about this the way we have for a whole lot of years.
Yeah, I thought we'd be further along with that. I remember reading the Ethereum Foundation website and like all these projects on there, and this is cusping. This is about, you know, getting ready to happen.
Yeah,
change the world. That was a few years ago. Yeah,
I think a parallel here from the consumer perspective was when, you know, Apple Pay first rolled out. There was a lot of consumer confusion out there about what it was, how I could use it, where I could use it, if I could use it, you know, and it had a very slow uptake there in the first couple of years when it came out. And again, it was just because consumers didn't understand it. You know, tech savvy and certainly the younger generations picked it up faster, but It was only after a very long tail of seeing other people use it and more merchants being able to accept it that we've seen it grow to what it is now. And I think, you know, cryptocurrencies are in the same bucket. You know, they've just need better consumer education on how to use it, where to use it, and really why it's a better payment method.
Yeah, some of the appeal, at least with the cryptocurrencies, is the blockchain part of it, where it eliminates, the goal anyway is to automate the settlement process.
Right.
Would that change your business significantly if that started being the case?
Not too much, because the settlement process is really between the merchant and the merchant acquirer, which it isn't us, right? We take the payment transaction, we decide when it's time to bill, how much to bill. We create that transaction and we send it off to the payment processor. The clearing part happens in the background with them. So if there was a new method for that, whether it's, you know, real-time clearing or some other method, that would be between that merchant acquirer and our client. But, you know, it might change the way that, you know, we present those transactions, the timing of them, especially if settlement could happen faster. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
You can say that about a lot of things these days, huh? 2020 is, who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's the tagline for this year. Who knows what's
going on? Yeah, yeah. I love seeing some of the memes, like the writers for 2020 are just going bananas, throwing everything in there. But yeah, it's you're definitely in a really interesting space, and you have great timing just starting before all of this and the e-commerce taking off as it has. So yeah, definitely keep up the good work, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, that's Nick Frederick, president of Rebar Technology, joining us this week. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news, and thank you for listening. We'll be right back.